This is the Saxo Market Call, the daily financial markets podcast, across asset classes and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Monday, 20th of March, 2023, and here we have another historic weekend. The last time around, it was Silicon Valley Bank, and here we are, another weekend, another crazy deal. This time, not really a bailout, but more of a, I think the best phrase here is a shotgun wedding, in which the S&P finagled UBS into a takeover of Credit Suisse, and UBS wringing a sweetheart deal in many ways out of the situation. It was certainly a sweetheart deal for shareholders that should have been wiped out to zero according to the old rules of the game, but the new rules of the game are that they were not wiped out. Receiving one share of UBS for 22.48 shares of Credit Suisse, which if I'm right, and big hedge here on my maths, but around 80 cents, Swiss cents on the Friday prices. Of course, I don't know where UBS is opening this morning. But the big deal here, Peter, was the wipeout of the so-called Tier 1 or AT1 bonds. Take us through, well, yeah, let's just delve into the situation rather than the typical market coverage of what happened on Friday. This is very unusual because the pecking order is you wipe out the equity and you do something on the bond side, where the bond side has seniority here. So take us through a little bit on the tier one bonds and what this all means.
Yeah, it's very, very unusual, and I think the question of the day is that did the S&P just invert the entire capital structure for banks? I was listening to a very interesting Bloomberg interview with Manus and Lacroix, the two journalists from Bloomberg. So apparently this press release when UBS and Credit Suisse announced the takeover was not joined by any international journalists except for those from Bloomberg. And when Lacroix got the opportunity to answer questions, she asked the question, why did you wipe out all the AT1 capital holders? So AT stands for additional tier one capital. We'll get back to tier one capital in a few seconds. And as she said, there was an awkward silence for maybe 10 seconds. So the question is, why did they do it? I don't think there is a firm answer to this. What we do know is that the S&P in this case did a unanimous decision or a decision on their own without consulting Europe, because it's a very, very key funding market. And we see the ramifications for banks in Europe this morning, and we'll have our banking monitor. We'll talk about that in a few seconds as well. So that's sort of what happened. And so the way the banks work is that under the new or the current regulatory framework, you have a lot of assets on your asset side on the balance sheet. All the different assets come with a risk weighting. And when you sum all the assets multiplied by their risk weighting or their risk probability, you get to a weighted total risk on the balance sheet. And you have to have capital against those weighted risk assets, or risk weighted assets is called RWA. And tier one capital is the most fundamental, the most core capital. So often it's mostly the equity, so the equity shareholders. Then the AT1 capital holders, additional capital holders, is often what is called hybrid securities. So it can be, perpetuity bonds. It can be bonds with different call structures, etc. The COCOs, as we have talked about on this podcast before. And it's a very important funding market in Europe after the great financial crisis. It has grown to a considerable size, if I remember correctly, north of 200 billion euros in capital. So this is not a small market. And when the S&P make a decision like this, they're tinkering with the market. And John, you're pointing, yes.
The 275 billion is what the Bloomberg article says. Now that 275 billion is somewhat less because of what the market is doing here and marking this down after this deal.
Yeah, so I think at this point, as we said with the SVB, the Silicon Valley Bank, what is different from 2007 is that back in 2007 and 2008, there was a slow snowballing effect. There was time for regulators to at least think about rescue designs of different financial institutions. This time around, it moves with such a speed that I just really worry that a lot of the regulators here and the policymakers, the time is so compressed that the probability is really high that they're making mistakes. And maybe this, again, was a mistake. We don't know still what are the long-term consequences of guaranteeing all uninsured deposits from the SVB Bank. That's still a big unknown. And now we have this inversion of the capital structure with a wipe out of the AT1 capital holders. What are the long-term consequences for this funding market in Europe? One thing is for sure, and that I'm 98%, I will put my hand on the, I'll bet on this, that it will mean that funding costs for banks, they were going up regardless because of this deposit game that we'll have to talk about again today. But it's going up because of what happens to the AT1 tier one capital market here. And John, before you talk about slide four, I just really quickly just want to highlight, it's not a market that I'm typically has. I think this has been mostly a shenanigan market. I had never really been onto this whole crypto thing, but I think the crypto industry and especially Bitcoin now has the perfect setup for what they have been trying to sell the world for 12 years. And I am deeply worried that if this is a snowball that keeps rolling, that suddenly you have a huge substitution effect on deposits. If you have the wider public questioning the value of having either insured or uninsured deposits with the banking system, and you convert it into short-term bonds because there's a huge yield you can grab there right now, or you go for Bitcoin, you go for stocks, you go for whatever, there's no value in having deposits, then a very big funding source for banks will disappear and the funding costs will go up. That's right now is my concern. So I think gold and Bitcoin are very good proxies of this potential distrust in the deposit system.
Yeah, and we actually had a little bit of a discussion on that on Friday. Peter, you and I said, I was noting the outperformance of Bitcoin relative to some of the other crypto, and it is that store of value side of things that is the appeal more than the whole the whole ecosystem of the rest of the network in cryptocurrencies. And you also mentioned the risk of these stable coins in the space, whereas if you have Bitcoin, you can hold it sort of physically off exchange in a wallet, etc. So it is interesting to notice that divergence of performance as well. But let's get back to some proximate indicators you can watch to get a sense of where the market is. And I think, in these situations, correlations kind of go to one. So you can almost pick anything, because if U.S. yields are continuing to go down, it's because there's a massive systemic stress trade on. And if they go up, it's beginning to be the opposite. But specifically, you can also zero in on something like, there's actually an ETF that tracks these bonds. It's called the Wisdom Tree Coco ETF. It trades in Italy. There are other, I think, some spinoffs of this listed elsewhere, but that's the one we picked out here. You can see it on slide four on the right there. It's a candlestick chart, and there's a huge markdown last week on the order of 10%, with Credit Suisse a significant portion of the holdings within that ETF. So that's a focus there. You can pull up a whole menu of European banks, which I think you have, Peter, later on a slide. And then just noting there's a general stress on credit that has really come into play here that you can see on that credit spread on the same chart there on the right on slide four, which is the high yield credit spread in Europe. And so you can watch that one. Hard to get a beat on that one relative to the ETFs, but you can also pull up your basic junk bond ETFs, JNK, HYG, etc. Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. I'm just pointing because so what we can also see on this these charts you have put in here on slide four, John, is that there is beginning to be a move now in the high yield. So that means that you have the higher funding cost of the banking system will send into higher funding costs for companies as well, and especially the high yield segment. And that's also what we've talked about in the last couple of quarterly outlooks, and the one we're writing right now, is that what happens now means that things are getting more ugly for smaller and medium-sized companies, and especially companies with poor business model or a significant debt leverage on their balance sheet. So it's really the time is now for equity investors to really think about how much exposure do I have to small caps, and how much do I have to what I call non-quality or junk companies, which can be fine in a positive credit environment, and when things are going well, you can get extra return from that. But when you get into this situation, all those gains you maybe got on this part of your portfolio in the past couple of years can disappear very quickly.
Yeah, and it's rapidly maturing the whole credit cycle and where we are, and the placement of the recession is brought nearer if this works into a credit to the economy. And then on the left there on slide four still, just put in that headline as well, the $275 billion market for these AT1 bonds. You can see the repricing of the Fed here, fair or not. Where we have the two-year posting a new high. That's the orange line. That's that's the price of the first two-year future. We had two-year yields at below 3.7% this morning versus above 5%. Was it less than 2 weeks ago? And you can see the repricing of the Eurodollar September future there. That's in black, the black candlestick. More than, if that's the left axis, by the way, at some points, over 200 basis point swing, and where the Fed will be by the end of this year relative to where we were This is a daily chart, so relative to where we were less than 2 weeks ago.
And John, a question for you. So as I said to you, and you put in this headline, at this pace, does Fed cut rates on Wednesday? It's a provocative headline. Right now, the market is pricing in slightly less than 25 basis point move, so they will do 25. The ECB went on with their rate hike as well. And as I said to you, John, if the Fed blinks here and they actually cut, just like in 1998 with LTCM, they cut in a increase in rate cycle and then they got back on the bandwagon when that problem was resolved. But I mean, I just have this sense that if they really do that this time around, they blink and not that the market will panic, but it will just send a very, very strong signal that we now will leave the notion that we can patch this thing up and move on and that we go into full crisis mode, right?
Yeah. At this point, I think the situation is bad enough for them to cut. And maybe the fundamentals may be there for it to be bad enough, but the market expression of it is not yet bad enough for this for them to actually cut rates. I think it's fair to get very neutral and to be concerned that they might be going flat or not doing anything this Wednesday. But it is not an enviable position for them to be in. It's a position they got themselves in together with the government. But let's see. I think it's 15 or in the teens of basis points that are priced for further tightening before, again, as I showed, the aggressive subsequent drop in there. And Ola, you're patiently awaiting the look here. You've put up a slide on slide five. These are a couple of your monitors you've had up before, also illustrating the scale of the reversal here in the Fed and the forward anticipation around what the Fed is set to do.
Yeah, because there's obviously a lot of speculation about the what's going to happen on Wednesday. I think what's for sure is it's one of the most uncertain outcomes that we've had for a long time. And just to finish off on your previous slide, that cocoa ETF is down another 10% this morning, trading around 68 from 75 on Friday. So it is taking a beating. Yeah, but we showed that the very short end of the yield curve last week, the 3 months minus 2 year. And it's back down to close to 90 basis points inverted this morning. And they were just highlighting once again that the last time we were here was in February 2001. And when we hit that 100 basis point, the Fed cut delivered a surprise cut within a few days after that. So the timing of that is very, very interesting. So we'll watch that closely. One market, you talked about Bitcoin, you talked about gold. There's no doubt that right now we are seeing a flight to some sort of safety. Gold has taken out $2,000 this morning. We're getting close to those previous two peaks from 20 and 22. If we look at something like the euro, we are less than 1% away from the all-time high in gold priced in euros. It does obviously highlight that that gold is showing strength, even though the dollar has not been adding some support to gold recently. So the collapse in yields and the demand, and I also say a market that really has been underowned. We saw the biggest pickup in ETF demand last week in a year. We saw speculators cutting their futures position by 70% last month. So there's a lot of scramble to get back into this market. So let's see whether we can build further this gain this morning. We will find some resistance here around that. I would say just look at the trend line 2025 perhaps, but it's mostly most certainly critical what the Fed delivers on Wednesday. And again, an old chart we used before, just to highlight what has happened on the previous three occasions when the Fed peaked. Obviously, this time around we can go from actually not having peaked to a rate cut. But we've seen in the past how gold has been very well supported in such a scenario.
Yeah, and into the FX market with this earthquake in yields and risk sentiment rolling over, the dollar's sort of come back in. It opened a bit weaker. There was a bit of hope, risk on at the Asian open overnight, but the dollar sort of stabilized. It's come back a little bit, but the really big mover continues to be the Japanese yen. If you look at that on slide six, the FX board overview, see that yen a positive reading on the broad trending basis up 4.2. That's a pretty hefty positive rating. But we haven't seen the huge, really huge acceleration breakdown just yet. I would suspect it's coming if this situation deepens and these yield, rewind in where we are yield wise, and this collapse in yields persists, even maintains, but much less if it persists and we see even lower yields. I focus on euro yen a little bit because we have a lot of focus on this AT1 business in Europe, as indicated earlier. So Will this work into the currency, whether it's the euro and to some degree sterling as well? Plenty of big banks in the UK also with this setup. So, so far, not particular signs of relative weakness, even though we have come in a little bit lower versus the US dollar in some places overnight. And then on the positive side, just to emphasize Ola's point, look at that 10.2 reading on gold. This is getting to almost unprecedented levels for the relative strength, trending strength there. And then I note the weakness in Noki that is certainly linked to crude oil. Slide 9, let's just a brief wrap up on the commodity space and crude oil. Is there some financial angle to all this as well, Ola, or do you think there's just a general sort of this is going to mean we've brought forward and perhaps deepened the recession risks from here?
I think there's most certainly a financial angle to it from financial traders, John, because the recent cut updates clearly showed how speculators continue to add strength or add length, especially in Brent, where we had the backwardation to support a long position. That backwardation is almost gone. We're down to just 5 cents now at the front end of the curve, and that's just adding to the downside pressure right now. So I say right now it's no longer a supply and demand focus that's driving this market. It's mostly fear, and when we have a situation of fear, then short sellers are quite easily in control. You can see that through the open interest, especially once again in Brent, the blue line here on slide 9 on the right hand side. We can see we are seeing the open interest picking up to levels that we haven't seen in a year, and that just indicate that as the market goes down, the number of positions goes up, and that's obviously driven by increased amount of short selling coming into the market. So so we need to see a close above 75 as a minimum for this to change. Otherwise, the next major level is down towards those lows we had in the second half of 2021 in the 64.50 area.
All right. Well, watch that. And Peter, we're watching these banks this morning, especially in Europe. So many huge European banks. Looks like, of course, Credit Suisse got a massive haircut on the takeover deal, getting the, what was it, one UBS share for every 22.48 Credit Suisse shares. I think the equivalent was something like 80 cents, as noted. But Deutsche Bank, the German banks, are in for some negative focus here, and Commerzbank are on the top four list there. That's quite interesting as well.
Yeah, because on Friday, it was mostly the some of the Swedish banks that were in focus. But today, the German banks are in focus, but also Banco Santander and Standard Chartered up there. The UK and the Spanish banks are some of the biggest issuers of AT1 capital here in Europe. So obviously the attention is there. And we should note as well, one of the whole things we have discussed with the whole held to maturity bond concept was a concept that arose after the great financial crisis as the, together with AT1 capital, which was part of the Basel III, the capital pillars and the new structure after the great financial crisis. And one of the ideas back then was that you had fair value for banks on all their instruments was one of the things that amplified the crisis during the great financial crisis. So we came up with all these ideas that, and it's all on the premise that there are no issues on the liability side. You have stable funding, right? Because then you can hold all the securities to maturity, and that has allowed this whole thing to go to develop. And the AT1 capital as well, you don't see any fair value adjustments. So right now, let's say the AT1 capital bonds are down 30-40%. It will not show up on the regulatory capital. It will still sit there at their initial cost. But the market is a fair value mark-to-market pricing mechanism, right? So you can create this world accounting-wise, but it doesn't really transcend into the reality when you have the market that it needs to price risk. So I think there's something there that is not right. But coming back to the slide 8, we have the Saxo's banking monitor right there. So we more mentioned the bank, so that's of course a key focus. And then one of the two biggest segments of the equity market in terms of asset holders are private equity firms, both either directly on their own balance sheet or the assets they manage in funds, and then real estate companies. We had Fonovia, which is one of the largest residential real estate holders here in Europe with a large portfolio of real estate in Germany, Austria, and Sweden. Very weak on Friday. They were up in the primary session as a check before we went into the studio. But I think private equity and real estate are key because if we have a deterioration in the funding market, the worst case scenario that could happen with all these elevated asset prices after many, many years of very low interest rates is that if suddenly you have those two parts of the financial system becoming to some degree a forced sale of assets to shore up capital or et cetera, right? So, and we already know that Blackstone, one of the largest private equity firms in the US, they're still seeing redemption in their in the biggest real estate fund in the US to a higher degree than what the redemption limits allow. So it's not a good sign, of course. And then on slide 10, the earnings watch, of course, that will take a backseat this week, of course. But I've highlighted in blue some of the names that are worth tracking, and Nike and Tencent obviously being the two most important ones. Nike will report after the Tuesday's US market close, and Wednesday Tencent is on, and Nike is seeing their growth rate coming down pretty pretty fast here, but it's still having a leading position in the sports retailing industry. And then Tencent is expected to report yet another quarter with zero revenue growth year on year. So since the fourth quarter of 2021, Tencent has been at flat growth. The regulatory headwinds in China are definitely not very positive for the technology sector here.
All right, and we have lots to look for at the on the macro calendar this week, but of course it is just market events, and whether we're rushing towards some other next step here in the need to bail out the situation if financial conditions worsen, and if systemic contagion fears are aggravated further. So we have China's Xi in Moscow apparently through Wednesday, but we have to watch for headlines on that, as well as whether Xi consults or visits or talks with Zelensky, and if something could be forthcoming there. We can all hope for peace, of course, but who knows. All right, and then rest of the week, UK CPI ahead of the Bank of England on Thursday. The CPI release there is Wednesday. Of course, the FOMC is absolutely massive, and where market conditions are going into that, as well as what their signaling is around this, after the ECB took this approach of simply saying, we recognize the tensions, we'll deal with the tensions if the time comes, we have the tools to do so, but we're going to continue ahead with our inflation fight. I don't think the market will take it very nicely if the FOMC delivers a similar message. A couple other central bank meetings there, S&B a bit more interesting than usual because of what just happened with their sort of arranging the shotgun marriage between UBS and Credit Suisse, and the Norges Bank with a very beleaguered Norwegian krona as oil prices are tanking. And I'll just bring up one more thing, and that is just as a background for those that are not U.S.-based or not focusing on the U.S. political situation, and that is Donald Trump and this whole indictment situation, whether he's actually indicted and in some physical way arrested. He's doing what he can to call for protest, and so the risk of sort of civil, what would you call it, civil disobedience or demonstrations or violence around this spectacle. I think the U.S. government and authorities would do well not to do something on the physical side of arresting Mr. Trump simply to avoid or for holding the peace, but just a situation to note, and that theoretically could pick up as soon as tomorrow. Okay, there's lots to keep track of here. We'll try to keep on top of things for you and see where things stand tomorrow when we're back with the next Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.